All right, great. There's an introduction for you. And so that was excellent. That was really fun because relationships. So here's the deal. Just if you weren't here last week, let's see if we can get you up to speed real quickly, and then we'll dive kind of right in. So this series is called, it's about relationships, and it's called hashtag The Struggle Is Real. And so kind of here's kind of the bottom line. There are a couple of bottom lines. So a whole summer, all the way through August, eventually you'll be able to say this. Or one of this or a few other things because you've heard it a million times. First of all, this, we are designed for relationships. That's how we're made. In fact, we're made that way not just because God made us to have relationship, but God made us out of his relationship. That's kind of weird, isn't it? But in the beginning, from eternity past until eternity future, there is a God who is one who, but three what's, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who are in a circle dance with each other. You guys ever watch a circle dance? If you come from kind of an ethnic background in Eastern Europe, you know, the Jewish traditions and some of the Slavic traditions, they do these circle dances where they put their arms around each other's shoulders and they start dancing, you know, and it's really cool. And that's what God does. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit have put their arms around each other's shoulders and they move in absolute syncrety with each other. And they are working to make the in his creation and to relate to his creation perfectly in perfect community. God is in community. You and I were made for community. And so we are made for relationships, but they can be a source of all sorts of pain, right? So we find that we were made for a relationship, and in Genesis 1 and 2, there was absolute perfect relationship. But then Genesis 3 comes along, and there's conflict, and there's a messed up deal. It's what we call the fall of man. And so there's this fall, and all of a sudden they begin to hide from each other and blame and shame one another. And then even in Genesis 4, we get to a place where Cain and Abel have conflict, and Cain kills his brother Abel. There's incredible conflict. You and I want to go back to Genesis 1 and 2, right? Where we can be naked and unashamed and be the full person that we are and no problems. We want to live there, and we keep demanding that we go back to Genesis 1 and 2. We pound the table. We're angry about it, in fact. Dadgummit, I want to go back to Genesis 1 and 2. The problem is we live in Genesis 3 and 4. And the rest of the Bible is all about conflict resolution all the way to the end of Revelation. It's all about conflict resolution, the whole thing. But we want to go back to Genesis 1 and 2. But he says, no, you can't go back there. You have to go that way. And the only solution down that road, remember? I mean, he's standing there, and he puts a cherubim up right there at the garden. And he says, you can't come back in. And he's got this big flaming sword that he's swinging around like this, saying, don't you dare come back in here. Because if you came back in here, it would never get fixed. So you've got to go that way. And there's another tree I want you to go to. One tree got you in trouble, you know, eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But I want you to go to another tree right down there, way down there. And so over the time, you go to another tree way down there, and it's called Calvary, a tree where Jesus was hung. Because only in the Spirit-filled life and what he does in our lives, only in that can he begin to give us the ability in the Spirit-filled life to begin to submit to one another correctly again. That's all what happens. So, these relationships can be a source of all sorts of pain in our lives, and we live with that. And how do we do that? So let me just go back, Ephesians 5, just a couple of verses. It says this, therefore be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love. That's what the commandment is, to walk in love. It's a command here. It's not an encouragement. It's a command. Walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself on that tree for us a fragrant offering and a sacrifice to God. Wow. Look at this in verse 15. Look carefully then how you walk. Underline that. Not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of the time, because the days are evil. We live in broken days. Just reality. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Don't get drunk with wine, for that's debauchery. It's a waste. It's not productive. But in a kind of a weird, kind of similar way, instead of getting drunk with wine, he says, I want you to be filled, controlled, and empowered by the Holy Spirit, by my presence in your life, he says. And then there's four results. If you want to know if you're filled with the Spirit of God, if I want to measure myself, if I'm filled with the Spirit of God, There are four things I probably should look at. The first one is this: addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. That doesn't mean you walk up to each other down at Schnucks and start singing, okay? You know, I mean, you can do it if you want to. But it basically means to interact with one another on the truths of who God is, bringing it to bear on the situation, and having it done with something of a fullness of heart. So it's addressing one another in those kinds of ways. Secondly, singing and making melody to the Lord with your hearts. Doesn't say you have to have a good voice, but it means to have in your heart a joy towards Christ. See? And then the third one is this: giving thanks always for everything to God the Father in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. To have a thankful heart is part of being filled with the Spirit. Is your heart thankful? Is your heart melodious? Are you interacting with one another and the truths of who God is? If you are, you're more than likely filled with the Spirit. If you're not, you might want to question whether you're allowing him to control and empower you. Now, the fourth one is really the killer. It's the kicker, right? Look at this, verse 21. Here's the fourth evidence of being filled with the Spirit: submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. Submitting to each other. And last week we talked about the fact that what that means is two things. One is to yield, and the other is to offer. To put it in different words, it would be this. It would be to stop resisting one another and stop hiding from one another. So you want to yield. You want to say, okay, I'm willing to give and take is really what it is, a relationship of give and take. So I'm going to take, I'm going to stop resisting you, I'm going to yield to you, I'm going to take, but I'm also going to give, I'm going to give of myself, the real me, to the real you in a real world with a real God. I'm going to give, I'm going to offer you what I am and who I am and what I think, and I'm going to put it on the table, I'm going to risk being right and I'm going to risk being wrong, but here's the real me, but I'm also going to be humble enough to receive and stop resisting you, to receive and have a relationship, a mutually submissive relationship. So here's kind of the big idea, and hopefully you'll get this over the whole summer, is we are designed for relationship, but along the way, those relationships got all messed up. And our only hope is a Spirit-filled life that'll give us the ability to submit to one another. That's our only hope. So let me just jump into something here. I want to show you a chart. A lot of times when I do premarital counseling with a couple, every time I do this, I do premarital, I use this assessment. Also, it's called Prepare. I also use the Enrich, which is for people who are already married, to kind of enrich their relationship. And there's a variety of categories that are in this assessment. I find it to be tremendously helpful. And eventually I'd like to train a bunch of you to do this with couples, because I would like to steal back from the culture weddings and marriage. We have abdicated it to the culture, and no one created this except for God himself, and we ought to steal it back. And I would like to see dozens of couples come through our church to either get married or to enrich their relationship, and I can't do all those people. So I'd like to train you to use this assessment to be able to walk this through with people. But in this one, there are 9 different categories. First one is this: it measures about communication. And in communication, it's all about, it measures how the quality and the quantity of communication that a couple has. And it explores how to share their feelings and understand and to listen to one another. It measures their ability to communicate. The second one that it does is conflict resolution. It looks at their ability to discuss and resolve differences. It measures how effectively they share their opinions, their ideas, even during times of conflict. And this is, oh, I love these two sections, you know, when you get into it with a couple. Now, the third one they talk about is partner style and habits. And it looks at the satisfaction of the personal habits expressed in their behavior with each other. And sometimes they have just certain habits that bother them. One couple I was talking to, and I said, are there any habits that you have that bother you? And she said, yeah, he does have one. And I said, really, what's that? And she said, well, his cocaine use bothers me. I said, wow, okay, that would probably bother me too. What do you think? You know, and they began to talk about it as if it was kind of real. And it was real, right? And so they tried to begin to deal with that. Then there's financial management, which explores opinions about spending habits, saving habits, and how to deal with debt and making financial decisions. This one's always very interesting to talk to them about. Leisure activities. Looking at the satisfaction of the amount of leisure time they spend together, similar interests, and the time they spend with others. Because you can't spend all your time with this other person. You've got to spend a little bit of time with someone else. And how does that go? Next one is sexual expectations. It looks at the satisfaction with their level of affection expressed as well as a dialogue concerning sexual issues. Because it's real. It's part of life. And so we talk about those things. I'm always stunned at the fact that they're willing to talk about that with a generally stranger. I just laugh on the inside, but I dive right in and we talk about them. So then about family and friends, looking at how they feel about each other's family. This is always fascinating. And their friends and their independence from them, this whole call to leave and to cleave. And how will that go? It's very interesting. Then relationship roles, the expectations that they have on how decision-making and responsibilities will be shared. And then the last one we look at is spiritual beliefs. It looks at how satisfied they are with the expression and practice of spiritual values and their involvement. Now, it's interesting. If you look at that, you think, well, which one's the most critical? And our tendency in church work, in Christian stuff, we'd say, well, the most critical one is spiritual beliefs. And oddly enough, it's not. Now, those are important, but oddly enough, the most important, the critical one that will determine the success of a relationship are the first two. Communication and conflict resolution. Those will determine the success of any relationship, whether it be in a marriage or with kids or at work or in your neighborhood or on a baseball team or wherever it is. Communication and conflict resolution is absolutely the most critical ones that will determine the success of any of those relationships. And maybe most importantly, conflict resolution. How do you resolve conflict? Because starting in Genesis 3, it was a part of our lives. And it's always going to be a part of our lives until the day the Lord comes back. And so how do you resolve conflict? This morning, what I'd like to do is I'd like to use a chart developed by Peacemaker Ministries. It's called the Slippery Slope. And it describes our options in dealing with conflict. And they're incredibly biblical. So it's going to be a bit of a survey on all sorts of things throughout the scriptures about how to deal with conflict and our different options, some of which are going to be healthy and some of which are not going to be so healthy. So let's put up kind of the big picture here real quickly. There are going to be three different ways to deal with conflict. There's going to be peacemaking, which is going to be the middle section, which is really what we want to aim at. But there's also going to be, on the left-hand side there, there's going to be peace-faking strategies. And then on the right-hand side, there's going to be peace-breaking strategies. So where I'd like to start is over here with the peace-faking strategies, okay? So these are escape responses. This is how we want to get into a conflict, and we just think, how can I get out of this? I just want to get out. There are three different things we do. The extreme, the way extreme, is suicide. Oddly and painfully and tragically enough, this is an increase in our country. This is on the increase. And in fact, in West County, as I've talked out here, our parking lot, just so you know, during the week is a favorite place for the police to hang out. They come and we love that, right? I mean, I love them hanging out there. We even have a portal in our internet system for them to use. But I've asked a number of them, what are the biggest problems here in West County? And they say, you know, crime's not the biggest thing around. Having things for kids to do is a big issue. Just they get bored and they start doing things that kids do when they're bored, which sometimes cause trouble. But he said the biggest issue are domestic issues. And when a family who's doing well, typically there's upper class, you know, kind of upper middle class, he says, but when life begins to fall apart, kids are in trouble, the marriage is in trouble, I lose my job, the house gets repossessed. The level of suicide is strikingly high. It happens when you want to escape difficult things. Most of us, now let's just admit it, most of us are not going to do that. But my guess is that every one of us has thought of it. It's crossed our mind. At some point or another, how can I get out? I have too. Now I'm not saying that's a dominant thought in my mind, but you guys, let's face it, it's hard. Sometimes you just think, how can I get out of this situation? Suicide's one. The next one is this, is flight, just run away. Just run away from the situation. Escape, you know, just fly away from it. Whether that mean for a week or a day or a month or a year? Or how do I just get out of this thing? The next one, maybe a little bit healthier, but not that great, is denial. People just live in denial. It's not just a river in Egypt. I mean, it's denial, right? I mean, people live in denial. Oh, there's not a real problem. We'll stuff this thing under the rug. We'll sweep it under the rug. It's not a big issue. But under there, it starts churning away, and it starts hurting you, and you're mad about it, and you're bitter, and you're anxious. And it's just denial and dealing with conflict. Now, let's go over. We'll jump into peace-breaking strategies. The ultimate one is murder. That's the ultimate break of conflict. It's what we see in Genesis 4, right? Cain and Abel. Cain gets mad at Abel. And what's he do? He says he kills him. And then God says, hey, where's your brother? He goes, I don't know where he is. Am I my brother's keeper? I'm not my brother's keeper. He'd killed him. You know what happens today? Unfortunately, it happens more often than we think in relationships. The news is full of it. And people choose this. Whether it be on one-on-one or in mass, that's how they solve conflict, is murder. The next would be litigation. We begin to sue each other. The scriptures talk about it all the time. This is an unhealthy way to solve a conflict. I'm just going to sue you. I'm going to take you for everything you're worth. I'm going to put you under. It's an attack strategy. I'm going to put you out, man. And I'm not going to do it physically, but I'll do it financially. And I'm going to sue you for everything you've got. It happens. Or maybe the next, a little bit better, but still not very good, is assault. We assault each other. Often in our culture, we probably assault each other verbally more than we do physically. But it happens physically. Several years ago in a local church, they took a survey, and they said, what's the biggest problem you have in your home? And physical abuse was the second most common thing of a problem in their home. Had no idea what to do with that. So assault really happens. So peace faking and peace breaking are not very good strategies. Okay? So here's six strategies you might be able to choose that are in peacemaking strategies. Okay? I hope this is very practical for us. There are even more practical things about, well, how do we do that? But here are just some ways to look at it. First of all, in peacemaking, one of the things that you can do is you can overlook the problem. You can just overlook it. That's not denial, okay? It's very different than denial. But there are times to overlook it. Let it go. Let it be. In fact, look at this in Proverbs 19. It says, good sense makes one slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook an offense. That doesn't mean you have to overlook every offense. Some have to be dealt with, but some need to be let go. It's a wise person who learns that, to let it go. To say, you know what, it's not worth it. It's okay. It drives me a little nutty, but let it go. Probably marriages would do better to find that place. Let it go. It's not that big a deal. Don't demand your way. You don't have to have it the way you want it. Let it go. So that's one, is to overlook. There's another way to do it, is reconciliation. You know, back on the overlook, and the difference between that and denial. Let me just go there for a second. I had a couple that I knew in college, and right out of college, they got married. They got married in the middle of the summer in Muscatine, Iowa, in a church that didn't have any air conditioning, and we wore brown tuxes that had peach shirts that had frills on the front. You remember those days? How many people remember those days? Yeah, how many people think, thank God we don't have those days anymore? And I mean, by the end of the wedding, my shirt was not only filled with sweat, the ruffles were filled with sweat. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a horrible place. But I'll never forget, this couple told me before they got married, we have never had a conflict, we've never had an argument. And I remember thinking as a 21-year-old, that is incredible. That's awesome. That is so neat. You know? Now, my theology wasn't very good, right? Because if I was thinking, oh, they're living in Genesis 1 and 2. But we don't live there anymore. We live in Genesis 3 to the end of the book. It's all about conflict. They'd never had a conflict. Guess what? Somebody wasn't participating, right? Someone, her, had decided to live in denial. She didn't just overlook. She lived in denial. And he was living in abuse and assault. In 9 months out of a terrible marriage. 9 years later, they're divorced. Of course. Because they didn't deal with reality. They never learned to deal with conflict. They either had none or they had it all the way. And it destroyed them. They either lived in peace faking or peace breaking. They never found peace making. So it wasn't just overlooked. Or you can reconcile. You can sit down and figure it out. And sometimes just sitting down and talking it through will allow you to reconcile it. And sometimes, look, in fact, here, look, in Matthew 18, they knew there was going to be conflict. Look at this. It says, if your brother sins against you, go tell him his fault between you and him alone. Don't make it, don't put it on Facebook. Don't Twitter it. You know, don't Instagram it. You know, it just makes it all of a sudden a big issue, far beyond what it ever should have been. I think that's one of the great dangers of social media, is we make a big deal out of things that it should have been kept private. And it says here, go alone, just you and him. And if he listens to you, if he engages and processes this with you, you have gained your brother. And then the issue stops. You let it go from there. Okay? So sometimes it's just reconciliation. If that doesn't work, you have to go into negotiation. You have to sit down, this is still between the two of you, and you have to negotiate a middle, an agreed upon thing that works. Sometimes reconciliation is just understanding each other. And you go, oh, I didn't get it. I didn't understand. Now I get it. We're good. Let's go. Sometimes you have to enter into negotiation. You have to find a middle place, a win-win rather than a win-lose or a lose-lose, right? In fact, look at this in Philippians 2, verse 4. So it says, let each of you look not only to his own interests, but to the interest of others. Taking in their interest, it matters. You have to engage that. It's not just about you. It's about this other person, too. You have to negotiate a win-win. That brings me to this illustration. You can come up and look at it later. But this is a great picture. Taken in the 1880s, the guy on this horseback is Geronimo, Chief Geronimo. This is just a few years before he was taken captive. He was held captive from 1886 until 1909 when he died, Fort Sill, Oklahoma. But he's horseback here. Next to him is Perico, his son. And then his son is holding a toddler. We don't know for sure who this toddler is, but I met a guy in Oracle, Arizona in 1995, and there's this picture in a store, and I thought it was totally cool, and it's signed up here, Chief Geronimo III. So there's this guy there that was evidently over 100 years old. He lived in his own house on he had a dirt floor, chopped his own wood, drove his own car, and it was a big silver van, they told me. And so I thought, well, that's cool, Chief Geronimo III. Man, that's got to be cool. So that was on a Friday. On Sunday when I was leaving town, I had spoke at a conference. I was leaving, and there was this big gray van that said Chief Geronimo III on it in scribbled yellow, you know, just sprayed paint. And I thought, well, I got to go in there. He was at a grocery store, a small little grocery store, and I thought, I got to meet this guy. So I went inside, and I looked all over. It wasn't a very big store, smaller than this room. And I found over in the corner by the meat section this really, really old Indian. I mean, he had cracks in his face as deep as the canyon. I mean, it was an old dude. And I looked up to him and I said, are you Chief Geronimo III? And he said, yeah, I am. Oh, he didn't say it quite like that. But, you know, he said, and I began to talk to him. And I thought, this is an incredible experience. And so I ran across the street and I bought this picture. Now, when I got home and told Diane the story, we were like, man, that's cool. Let's get that thing framed and put it somewhere. And so we went down to the frame shop, right? And so we're looking through the frame shop, and Diane went that way, and I went this way. And I think we had one or two kids by then, so we were dragging them along. And so I found this frame and this matting that were just tremendous. They were great. And then Diane found this other matting and frame. They were terrible. I mean, you know, they're just terrible. And so we began. So we got back together, and we each brought a frame and a matting, and we started talking, and we couldn't agree. And we began to, right there in the frame shop, have a little bit of a conflict. I don't know if anybody ever done that. Okay, I'm not sure you've not done that, but Diane and I did it, and we had this little conflict right there, and eventually it was clear that someone needed to solve the conflict, and so I decided to solve the conflict in a very mature way. I said, it's my picture, and it's my picture, and I literally said that, it's my picture, you know, so, but I don't know exactly how, but somehow we ended up at the front desk where there was a gal who was checking people out and giving people help, and we kind of revealed our conflict to her, and she said, well, actually, I think if you take your frame and take your matting and put them together, they're much better. And she did it. And we're like, oh, wow. That's what it was. So what happened in that whole thing is we were negotiating, right? And we didn't do a very good job of negotiating. And what it brings us to is that whole next level. Let's go here to the next one. Is you can move from negotiation to mediation. That's where you get other people involved. And that we couldn't find solution, and so we went to the desk, and here's this gal who mediated between us, right? She said, well, why don't we have a win for you with the matting and a win for you with the frame, put them together, and you'll have a better picture. And we both said, yeah, that's right. So it was mediation. Sometimes you need someone to help you. And so we came up with this picture. It hangs in my office. It's one of my favorite pictures ever, you know? And so it goes with me everywhere. I use it as a marital counseling tool. Because that was used that way in my life. Sometimes you need someone to mediate between you, whether it be in marriage or kids or at work or in your neighborhood or at the baseball team, wherever you might be, mediation. In fact, in Matthew 18, in that whole process, you go to your brother and you expose things, and if he listens to you, you've won him over, it stops right there. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two others along, right? You take them to help you work this out. Doesn't mean everybody's right or everybody's wrong all the time. You just need someone to listen and help mediate this thing. Okay. After that, if that's not successful, the next one is called arbitration. You need to arbitrate. And what arbitration is all about is that you come to the table and you present your case. Each of you present your case. And then you give it up to the person to decide, and you agree to live by whatever they say. They do this in baseball all the time, right? You hear that a player wants more money, and they'll take it to arbitration. They both present their case, then the arbitrator decides, and you've agreed to obey by what they say. Wow, it's an incredible thought. In fact, it's even biblical. Look at this in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. It's all about being suing each other. And taking it to the civil authorities, and how he's saying, are you kidding me? Why would you take this to the civil authorities? Someday, you're going to judge the world along with Christ. And he goes, if you're filled with the Spirit of God, why would you take this to a civil authority? Why wouldn't you take it to the church and take trustworthy people and say, okay, we're going to trust you guys. We're going to let you arbitrate. Because if someday you're going to judge the whole world, you ought to be able to judge these small earthly things well. You ought to be wise enough and you ought to be humble enough to give it to them. It says, if you have disputes in such matters, appoint judges, even men of little account in the church. Meaning that the Spirit of God is supposed to be powerful enough to help you arbitrate and pick what is wise. And you ought to be humble enough to give it to them and let them decide for you. Is that a radical thought? That is so radical from modern day ways we do church. That this is crazy, and it ought to be the way it is, that we trust each other. And at the end of that, say, okay, I'm going to trust not only you, but I'm going to trust God with this, and let it be. And I'm willing to lose what I think is right for the good of what God wants to do and what the body of Christ is all about. Wow. Well, what if arbitration doesn't totally work, then we move to this place called accountability. Where we are accountable to each other. We are held accountable by those around us. Look at this in Matthew 18, verse 17. It says, if he refuses to listen to others, when you've taken some with you and he refuses to listen, it says, tell it to the church. Tell it to the whole group. Expose it for what it is and hold them accountable for their behavior. If it's so destructive, you see, it's right up next to peace breaking, right? But it's still a peacemaking strategy. We hate to get to that point, but it's true. And that we hardly ever do that in the church today, right? To really expose it to the whole church. But it's always for the purpose of bringing them back to reconciliation, bring them back to reinstatement. But sometimes there has to be accountable. Wow. So here's the deal. Peace faking, over here on the far left side, peace faking is actually all about, when I do this, it's actually all about me. When I fake peace, it's all about me. I'm going to protect myself. I'm going to live in denial. I'm going to run away. I'm going to commit suicide. It's all about me and protecting me. Peace faking strategies are all about ourselves. On the contrary, or in the opposite, peace breaking strategies are all about you. When I choose to assault you, it's all about you. I want to say, you're the problem. I'm going to assault you. You're the problem. I'm going to litigate against you. You're the problem. I'm going to murder you. You're the one I'm going to tear apart. You're the one I'm going to hurt. You're the one I'm going to gossip about. You're the one I'm going to try to destroy. It's all about you. But seldom are problems all about me or all about you. Most of the time, they're all about us. And peacemaking strategies are all about us. They're all about one another. It's all about the fact that we need to work this out. We together matter, whether it be a marriage, parents and children, the work environment, neighbors, the baseball team. It's all about us. We have to do well together. That's what we need to do. So here's the deal. Let's put it in red. This is our goal, is to be in this place of one another, about us, whether it be overlooking, reconciling, negotiating, mediating, arbitrating, accountability, whatever it takes in that to make peace with each other that's real and not a fake and not a break. So we come to the place where we ask the question often, so therefore, what now? What do we do? What do we do? So here's the deal. Here's the reality is we tend to gravitate towards escaping and attacking. Isn't that sad? Isn't that horrible? But that's where we tend to go, right? We want to deny or run away, or we want to assault and we want to litigate and we want to hurt. Somehow we gravitate in this slippery slope. We go to the bottom of the sides. We tend to gravitate towards escaping and attacking. Somehow this peacemaking seems to be way too hard, right? It'd be easier to run away. It'd be easier to assault. It'd be easier to be about me. It'd be easier to be about you than to be about us and about our oneness and our togetherness and our one anotherness. Somehow it seems way too hard, but just think about where it takes us. These inappropriate ways to deal with conflict damage relationships and damage them deeply and long and hard and generationally. Wow, it can't be that much better. And that's because, the reason it seems hard is because it'll require that we stop resisting one another and that we stop hiding from one another. And over the years, we have learned to stiff-arm each other and to hide from each other in all sorts of big ways and all sorts of small ways. That's how we live. And it'll mean that we have to stop. And what it brings us to is to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, to yield and to offer because we respect Christ so much and what he did for us and the relationships that he's called us to. If we stop resisting and stop hiding, we can be in a mutually submissive relationship with people that brings honor to Christ. Wow. You guys, I don't know about you, but I find these really hard. Maybe you find them easy. Maybe it's no big deal for you. I find them hard. It challenges me. And so let me ask you this. What are you? What are you? Let me see if these people might be who you are. One says, I'm an attacker. I tend to be an attacker. I tend to assault people. I tend to make it all about them, see if I can rip them. Are you an attacker? Or maybe you say, I'm an escaper. I don't like the conflict. I don't want to do it. I want to avoid it. I'm going to deny it. I'm going to run away from it. I'm going to do whatever I can to get out of here. Are you an escaper? Guys, both those don't help. Maybe you could say, hey, I'm really a vacillator. You know, I kind of go back and forth. I hide sometimes, and I attack other times. I escape at times, and then I attack. And I seem to be totally schizophrenic. I'm a vacillator between the two. Or maybe you say, and this is what I think God's calling us to, is to say, I choose us. I choose us. I'm going to be a peacemaker. I'm going to be about us. I'm going to be about one another. And as hard as it might be, that's what I'm going to be all about. Because here's the deal. The struggle is real, right? Hashtag the struggle is real. It is real. Every one of us puts up with it, lives with it, and does it. Let me go back and just kind of, here's our big thought for the whole summer. We are designed for relationships, right? But along the way, those relationships got all messed up. But our only hope is the Spirit-filled life that will give us the ability to submit to each other. I think that's the only way to go. So let me put some question marks up here. What do you think? What do you think, really? You don't have to answer. Luke and Beth made you answer. I won't make you answer right now. What do you think? What do you think? Here's my thoughts. Some of you are saying this. You must be out of your ever-living mind. You're crazy. You don't get it. You don't know what this has cost me. Are you out of your ever-living mind, Hughes? Which may be true, but not on this one. Or maybe you're saying this, that's what my heart aches for. But, and let's call it like it is, it's a big but, right? That's what my heart aches for, but, Or maybe you're saying this, I have a lot of wounds that need to be dealt with. I have a lot of stuff in my life. I can't even get to reconciliation. Because all the junk that's going on inside of me and trying to deal with that, heal that. Or maybe you're saying this, it would take an act of God to help me get there. And that is exactly what I'm saying. That is exactly what I'm saying. See you next week.